Welcome once again to another episode of There's Just Something About Kansas City. I couldn't be happier than having this guy sitting across from me, the one and only Billy Brimblecom. And, I know so much about you, heard so much about you. Of course, we all know about Steps of Faith. We all know you're a drummer from the old rock and roll and grunge age and all that sort of thing. But your story is absolutely incredible, and we are so happy to have you on the podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Like I said, when y'all reached out, I was kind of shocked. I was like, wait, why? So thank you. It's an honor to talk to you, man.
Yeah, it's great to get your story about, you coming up being a drummer.
Yeah.
Okay. And everything you've done in that industry. And all of a sudden now you're the executive director of Steps of Faith. You just go, he does what?
Yeah. Real traditional career path.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about it. Yeah. You grew up in Shawnee and Lenexa, I think, right?
That's right.
You went to Shawnee Mission North.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about growing up. Don't take us past 11 years old because that was an important time in your life.
That's okay. Sure. Yeah, no, I started playing the drums when I was 11 in sixth grade. I grew up, right around here, like you said, Shawnee, Lenexa. Music. As a kid, I was really into music. I was really into comedy and Saturday Night Live and, Bill Murray and Eddie Murphy movies and all of those things, And so, and then in particular, so like in middle school, for instance, it was like, eighth grade. Middle school is a terrible time. My son is about to start sixth grade, so he's getting close, and I'm just like, oh, dear Lord. But it was tough, and boys played sports, and I played sports, but I wasn't like good at sports. I could have been better at basketball had I practiced, but it kind of hit that point where I could go down the street in the cold to the park, which was only a couple blocks away, and shoot baskets and get better. Or I could stay in my room and put on, Led Zeppelin and Black Crowes albums on headphones and play along on the drums. And so the drums won. And fortunately, nobody in my middle school in eighth grade was like, that great at the drum set. So, that kind of saved me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, a disgruntled relative who decided, okay, what I'm going to do to get back at them? I'm going to give Billy a set of drums at 11 years old and let him drive his parents absolutely crazy. So,
to both of my parents' credit, my parents were divorced, so my dad bought me the drum set. So it very well, hadn't thought of it that way. It could have been like, this will stick it to his ex. Yeah. But she went with it, man. And somehow, especially back in those days, we either lived in like a condo or a duplex. So we like shared a wall with somebody.
Wow.
And I only remember ever getting complaints like when we were practicing the garage with the door open. Well, that was the whole band doing it. But I think I just would always practice like after school and maybe no one was home. But it all worked out. My dad bought me my first drum set for Christmas in sixth grade and, it was kind of off to the races. Yeah.
Yeah. So then you get to high school.
Yeah.
And you're still playing. Are you a member of a group? You're not really a member of a group at that time. You're just playing with friends.
You
guys are dreaming about being a garage band.
All that.
Ends up making it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I did all of the music you could do at school, in high school. And before I started high school, I had a really great drum teacher who had just graduated from Shawnee Mission North. This guy, Sage Eaton. Shout out to Sage Eaton. He was an incredible drummer. And my first teacher. And he, I'd been playing for a few years at that point. And then,
so you were self-taught to begin with.
I was self-taught.
Right? And you said you're listening to Led Zeppelin or whoever, and you're just trying to figure out what they're doing, right?
That's how I learned to play. Is like, my dad had played drums a little bit. He showed me a couple things like, when we brought the drum set home, and that was it. And so I was doing a lot of things completely wrong. It's just, but eventually figured it out, but basically learned from playing along to music. And and my first drum teacher right before high school, I started taking lessons. And then got so much better, so much faster. Cause like, oh, hey, here's how you actually do that. But he had said, he was like, you're going to do jazz band at school, right? I was 14. I wasn't into jazz. I was like, why?
I haven't been to 18th and Vine yet. Leave me alone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was way later. And so he was like, it's the only way you can play drum set at school. And I was like, oh, that's great. So, I mean, funny enough, then I did it in a couple years. It took a couple years, but then I completely fell in love with jazz and went to college to pursue jazz. But I did all the music you could do at school. I was in a band with my friends that would, you know, play together in the garage, you know, and maybe every now and then play a show or a talent show or whatever. And then when I was about 16, then I started playing in like clubs. You know, I started playing in—
That was at 16?
Yeah. When I was 16, I started playing in clubs with other high school, with this guys in this, my high school band. And we would often be booked, you know, back then you're passing demo tapes to promoters to get booked and that kind of thing. And we did not disclose in the demo tape or any of the information that we were teenagers. So many times, fortunately, my dad was often with us or like, you know, because he was a music fan and was supportive and into it. But many times we would show up and they would be like, you guys are kids. You can't be in here.
Yeah, right.
And so we would have to like, I remember one time we had to like stand like backstage or like behind the monitor board or outside or whatever until we played, and then we would have to play and then immediately leave.
Yeah, right.
Like we weren't allowed to be there.
They can't serve drinks. Okay. They aren't allowed to serve drinks. Get them up on stage and get them out.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? Yeah, that happened a lot.
Yeah. That's fun. So you're actually in bars.
Yeah.
And so do you remember your first payday, payday for a job like that?
There's a few of them. I mean, I remember we also played right over here. We played, this was not a bar, obviously, but we played the parking lot of Sarco Par Trails Park.
That's right. I know where that is.
Yeah. And so I think we got paid, but I was always in these bands that were like huge because they were like high school bands.
Oh, okay.
So you'd also have like horn players in the band. So we probably maybe did get 50 or 100 bucks like as the band.
Right. Everybody got a buck.
Yeah. So no, that was one of the first ones I remember. I remember playing the park. I remember playing, but before that even, yeah, we played like the Lone Star in Westport.
Oh, sure.
Was the place where we were like, oh, hey, you can't be here. And the Grand Emporium, of course. I played the Grand Emporium a bunch. Yeah, I think probably it was the Lone Star was the first place where we, I think, got paid. But that was like, you can't be in here.
Right. You know? So that's all through high school. And then—
Yeah.
You graduate, you go to KU, right?
Yeah.
And you're going to study jazz.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
And you're in a marching band.
Yes.
Right? You're in the marching Jayhawks. So that was pretty fun. Yeah. Were you only there for that first year? Were you only there as a freshman?
You know, I was only, I always say I lived, I often refer to my quote unquote college years even because I lived in Lawrence for 6 years and lived
So you really did graduate in
some
ways, right?
I graduated from something, that's for sure. But no, I was only in school for a year because and I was very, very passionate about jazz drum set. And Dan Gailey, the jazz professor still there at KU, was hugely influential on me. And yeah, did Marching Jayhawks. It was a very good football team, was very, very good then in 95.
It was. One of the good years.
It was one of the very good years. And so, it was good. And then at semester of college, that first year of college, I ended up joining this rock and roll band, Stick, which was a huge local band at the time. And, you know, I often refer to, because this was on MTV News. MTV News was once a thing. You know, there were several cities after you mentioned grunge, after that kind of explosion happened in the early 90s, that were the quote-unquote next Seattle for about 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And Lawrence was one of them. And so, yeah. So I that's also, I think, in retrospect, why I didn't stick it out in college. It's just because I had joined this band. These guys were 10 years older than me. It was a sinking ship at the time. The band was winding down, which I didn't realize, but I was 18 years old and hot to trot.
Somebody said, hey, we love you, kid. Come on over here and help us out.
Yeah, it was my friend Mason Fan who was in one of my high school bands. He was like a year or two older than me. And then somehow he befriended these guys, and then they needed a new bass player, and then he joined the band. And then very shortly thereafter, the drummer quit. You know, again, the band was clearly ending. And so
right off a ship. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and then I auditioned and that, I mean, kind of changed the trajectory of my life really, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And then just a couple of years later, you decide I might form my own band here. Right. Yeah.
Creature Comforts came out of that. Yeah. The night I auditioned for Stick, I was talking about this the other day because I was in San Diego recently and had dinner with the guitar player of Stick, my old friend Mike Tobin, who's like my big brother. I hadn't seen him in a long time, and we were reminiscing about all this. But the night I auditioned for that band, it was December of 95. I was 18 years old. These guys were 10 years older than me, other than my friend Mason, who was 2 years older than me. But but my friend Mike's roommate was this guy, Chris Toll, and then his buddy, J.D. Warnock, was there. And then along with our other friend Brian, we started the Creature Comforts a couple years later.
And that worked out pretty well. You go about 5 years?
Yes, very good. Yeah.
Just about,
about 5 years.
You go to 02, and then all of a sudden you break up, and I don't know, then 03, you go from there and you joined The Start at that point, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And how was the music changing for you at the same time that, what was the genre, were the genres changing?
Or big
were
time.
You sort of,
Yeah. The Creature Comforts, you know, the Creature Comforts, we were kind of like a power pop band. You know, we were like the Replacements or Cheap Trick or Big Star, bands like that. You know, and I love that kind of music. And then The Start, I mean, at that point, I was like very clearly like, music was my life, and that was what I was choosing.
You were on your trajectory.
I was on my trajectory to make a living as a musician. Yeah. And a friend of mine that I knew from my touring days with the Creature Comforts had joined this band, The Start, which was from Los Angeles. Very, very different band. It was kind of like a mix of like a punk band and like an 80s new wave dance band, female singer. I mean, it was incredible. It was, you know, we did a lot of great things. I had never toured the West Coast, for instance, you know, because we always were like, oh, it's expensive to get out there.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
we toured New England and Texas and Midwest like nonstop. But, you know, so, you know, I went to Europe with The Start and, you know, we did a lot of touring, open up for The Offspring. Speaking of punk rock bands, we were on their record label and, you know, made a record at Sunset Sound where so many of my, almost every one of my musical heroes had worked, you know, Led Zeppelin, Prince, you name it. So it was a good thing, but that was about another year I did that.
Okay, yeah. And in 04 you go to Blackpool Lights, right?
That's right.
Correct?
Yeah.
And that was going to be good for you, except for 05, which we're going to talk about. That was the turning point in your life in a lot of ways, but you didn't let it slow you down or stop you from doing what you love, which is the incredible part of the story. So talk a little bit about 05.
Yeah. So yeah, I left The Start, came home. My buddy Jim Suptic, who was on a break from the Get Up Kids, his band, he was starting a new band, and so we together put together Blackpool Lights. And so in 1999, I was in this terrible car accident.
Okay.
Driving on K-10, right as I was pulling into Lawrence.
Terrible road.
Coming from here. Sure. Well, and it was one of those things where it's like you know, like when a snowstorm comes on really fast and all people are all over the road. And it was one of those things. So I was in this terrible, terrible car accident right as I was pulling into Lawrence. And, you know, the jaws of life were used to pull me out of the truck. And I had crushed a couple vertebrae in my back. I was very, very lucky that it wasn't worse. It was a very, very bad car accident. The insurance adjuster told my dad when he went to get my stuff out of my truck that was, you know, at the tow lot, I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, oh no, he survived. Yeah, it was bad. So, but later that summer, long story short, my back was healed and everything, but I started having this crazy pain in my left ankle. And so that, and really bad for like 3 nights, then it went away for 3 or 4 or 5 months. So that just kind of over time from 99 to 2005, that pain started happening more often.
Right.
When it would happen, it would last longer and it would be a higher level of pain.
Yeah.
It was like a 10.
And like a typical guy, okay, it goes away. I'm fine.
Right. Yeah. And I even had it looked at a couple years in by the orthopedist that had treated me in Lawrence from the accident. I was like, do I have like a shin splint? Like what's the stress fracture? What's happening here? And, you know, I now know what we were looking for wouldn't have shown up on that kind of scan. But yeah, so I eventually went and got it looked at early 05 and we thought it was a neurological issue. It wasn't neurological. And then we did an ultrasound and then, you know, many, many scans followed. But the ultrasound showed that there was a large mass in my left ankle. So yeah, test. We determined that it was a scary mass and it was Ewing's sarcoma, which is a lot of different kinds of sarcomas. They're all bad cancers. Ewing's sarcoma is pretty rare. It's typically classified as a rare childhood bone cancer, but I was 28. And so, yeah, that was bad news.
Yeah, I would say so.
So
when you first And you remember your first reaction when you heard it was, they probably said, well, you've got Ewing sarcoma. You probably said, what's that? And they said, cancer.
Yeah.
So do you remember your first reaction when you heard
that? Yeah, I mean, we knew that we did a surgical biopsy where they were able to determine quickly that it was a type of cancer, and they thought it was lymphoma. And they said, we'll get back to you with the full pathology within 3 to 7 days. The full 7 days go by, and they said, we want you to come in for,
That's never good news.
Yeah. And so I met with the orthopedist, Dr. Howard Rosenthal, and he said, okay, well, we thought it was lymphoma, and I wish it was lymphoma. It's this thing called Ewing sarcoma. Yeah. But he was basically said, like, we got to get to work right away. So, yeah. And he had told me before the biopsy all of the things that he thought it could be, including sarcoma. But I remember he had said, if it is a sarcoma, we have to remove the tumor and everything that it's touching. And I said, so?
What are you saying?
And he said, the only reason you would lose your leg would be to save your life. So I knew that it was a possibility, you know, out of the gate going into it all. And so I was in got into chemo right away after a bunch of tests. Fortunately, it was a very big tumor in my left ankle, but it had not spread above the knee.
Didn't
or
into metastasize.
My lungs. Yeah, hadn't gone anywhere else. And so, yeah, I got into chemo right away. Like I said, the band was just getting started. And so then it was like, okay, well, we don't know what's going to happen to me. Let's hurry up and make this record. And so we went in the recording studio and I banged out all the drums in 2 days for this album, the Black Polites album, which is available on Spotify and wherever you stream music. I'm very proud of that album for a lot of reasons, but, then, you know, we're rolling into summertime, and then basically it was like, okay, in order to get clear margins and feel like we're going to get rid of the cancer and do our best to save your life and keep you alive and have this, hopefully, you know, there's no guarantees. There's no 100% with cancer. We feel that we need to amputate the leg. So yeah.
Did they think they could, above the ankle at some time or whatever, but they eventually took it off where? Below the knee?
Just above the knee.
Oh, just above the knee.
Yeah, because the tumor was so big and it was pretty high up, you know, and it's kind of like you got to get good margins. You know, it's like my dad, and actually several people I know recently have had like these little skin cancer spots, you know? And it's like a little pin spot, but then they take the size of a quarter around it just to make sure, you know. So it's kind of the same idea. But also, you know, fortunately, Dr. Rosenthal, you know, knew like, okay, we've got to get rid of the cancer and do our best here to get good margins, but also set him up in a way that he's going to be able to use a prosthesis well, use a prosthetic leg. Mm-hmm. So mine's right above the knee. So I have like, you know, almost all of my residual limb just above the knee. So that's actually like being an above the knee amputee, like actually like helpful because I've got more of the real me to operate the robot me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so for you at the time, when you knew it had to happen, it comes off, it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. You still had your goal. You still had the Blackpool Lights. You still had something. Did you ever go through, I'm sure you went through all the emotions.
Yeah.
Depression, I'm sure, anger.
Yeah.
Whatever. But you ended up coming out the other end. Do you credit that most with having something to do, having something on the outside? People needed you at that point?
Yeah, it's a combination of a few things. I'd say three things. It was very much there was the light at the end of the tunnel of I'm very happy, I'm very proud of this music I've made with my brothers and we're gonna go out and tour the world and you know, do it, go after it. Right. That was a thing. Kim Haynes, who's Dr. Rosenthal's nurse to this day, who's an angel. She gave me some of the best advice I'd ever been given, which is you need to feel the emotions about this and you need to grieve the loss of your leg, like the loss of a loved one. Gave me a bunch of books on this kind of thing and everything. Some of the books I read, some of them, but it was really helpful. I've realized just recently that I actually, while I can fly off the handle and be really impatient and frustrated and angry.
I've heard that about you.
Wait a minute. Is that in the notes?
So they went, Frank, you sure you want to interview Billy? I said, yeah, I'm going to interview Billy. We'll find out.
That's right. We'll see. It'd be an adventure. But no, I realized that I actually have just in the last few years that a little bit of I have this thing that I naturally do, which is, good and bad, which is the ability to turn every negative into a positive. So that can be bad. And so now I don't feel that I have like suppressed the emotions around losing my leg. I feel like I talk about it all the time and that's good. But it was hard to, I didn't want to feel that way. I just wanted to move on, you know? So yes, it took a long time, but yeah, the light at the end of the tunnel was the band and getting out playing, that great advice from Kim. And then also like, you know, God and friends, you know what I mean? I was like surrounded by like so many people and I really felt like, you know, the presence of God throughout all of that. And so it was a lot.
Yeah. And it was probably, they were probably talking to you about it. Well, you can also be a spokesperson for, you know what I mean?
Sure.
To have this. And I know
some of you're busy.
Right. Go limp up.
Yeah. It's like
Mount Kilimanjaro. No, thanks.
There was so much of that and like running marathons. Cause it's just like, that's what you do when you lose a limb. In order to make it okay, you then go do something crazy physical feat. And then it's all better, you know? And it's like, I just wanted to be able to walk again.
Yeah.
And play drums.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Just go walk, sit behind drum set, and go right back at it. How long were you off from the band at that point? We don't have to belabor this.
But. Yeah, no, it was the band did a tour to set up the record that started like the day before the day of my surgery with sub drummer that I helped find. And so they did a few tours, like two tours. And then I was done, you know, chemo was wrapping up like at the end of the year in 2005. The band played a show on Thanksgiving here in town. And I got up and played the last song of the night, which I could barely get through because I was so weak. And so my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, said...
Allison.
That's right, Allison. She said it's as if... the torch was being passed back to its rightful owner. She said that in an email. So it was a really emotional night. And yeah, I mean, then we were, you know, we were rehearsing and on tour in March.
Yeah. And then you ended up staying with them till 2007, correct?
Yep.
Right in there.
Yep.
And then you moved to Nashville, which for a musician has to be like this. Man, I'm going to Nashville.
Yeah.
But you were going as a session drummer, correct?
Man.
Is that right?
Very good. Yes.
Okay.
That was the hope.
You know, I've seen the documentaries and stuff. You'll see them on these, you know, they'll do them on Singers or whatever.
Yeah.
And you always see them go into a thing. And here's these session guys.
Yeah.
Okay. Who aren't, it's not their band. It's we're making this.
Right. Yeah.
And these, and so that's what you did. Who did you do sessions for? Who
was I mean,
that what you did?
Yeah. And I did some touring too. I mean, all people that were mostly excellent, but none that were like, you know, huge names by any means.
Yeah.
So yeah, the moving to Nashville was I just wanted more opportunities to make a living playing music. You know, again, the theme. I just from the time I was 16, I just wanted to make a living playing music. And so, yeah, moving to Nashville, the hope was that, you know, because studio hours are usually like banker's hours, you know. And I was like, I want to do that and hopefully start a family with my wife. And there was a lot of studio stuff, which was really, really great. Again, I didn't play on like huge records or with huge artists. Okay. I did one huge audition. I mean, I did auditions and things like that, but I did one like thing that you would think that you would do when you're in Nashville. You know, I auditioned for Little Big Town,
The
country band, and they're excellent and they're wonderful. It was a very bizarre experience. I was absolutely convinced I was going to get the job. Did not get the job, and that's actually like one of the best things that happened to me because it's like one of those weird sliding doors moment. Had I got that gig, and then it like
your whole life takes off in a different
way, and they've been through, you know, 10 drummers since then, you know, and so no offense to them, shout out to Little Big Town, appreciate the opportunity, but they would not know me if they saw me, and even if I said the name and probably even replayed this story to them, they probably would not remember, but it was working in Nashville but it was really more touring than being in the studio. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's hard. I was away from my wife and then we had our first baby. And so then
Leo,
that's right. Thank you. And so then when touring came back up again, particularly with this artist I've been working with named Katie Herzig, who's wonderful, amazing, beautiful, excellent, very talented. It was a different thing. Touring with her in 2012 changed everything for me. It was really just wonderful. Opened up so many doors. You know, I was also working in New York City on this musical my friend had created. And it was really this incredible time. My wife became pregnant in that time. Anyway, touring with a family, I was like, this is
not good.
No, thank you. yes, I don't want to do this, which was a perplexing way to feel because it's all I'd ever wanted to do.
Yeah. Okay, so you're there and you're in Nashville. Now all of a sudden, where'd the idea germinate? I think we should go back to Kansas City. You know, because people are going to think, this guy's a musician. He's in Nashville. Yeah. What more do you want? He's touring. He's doing all these great things.
Well, it was one of those things where the idea was really three things. We loved Nashville. We never loved living there. We very much missed Kansas City. And then Steps of Faith, shortly after Leo came into the picture, Steps of Faith came into the picture 11 weeks later. And, so music kind of became less and less. And so then it was like, what are we doing here? We just, you know, especially in that time, this 2013, 2014, the Royals are winning, you know, the city is like becoming revitalized and energized in ways that it had,
personality's changing.
Everything was exactly. Yeah. And so we just missed it. And then as more, you know, as our second child came into the picture, it was like, let's move home. Like I can do Steps of Faith anywhere. And
sure,
I think maybe better and, you know, not necessarily easier, but like the guy who had hired me for Steps of Faith, I got his blessing to move back here. And he said, I think that you can maybe grow this thing faster in your hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think you might be right. Yeah. And boy, was he, you know?
Yeah. So you move back. I don't know if I want to bring up Summer Breeze and Yacht Rock after all the other stuff you did. Okay. I'm not sure. I see Billy pounding out the drums with a Yacht Rock song, but whatever pays some of the bills, right?
Short of my wife, it's maybe my longest running relationship is that band. So.
And so you go to Steps of Faith, and where did you start? No, you're now the executive director of Steps of Faith. Which I just think it's incredible, but everybody wonders how this grunge drummer, rock and roll guy became the executive director of Steps of Faith. How'd that happen?
Like I said, very traditional career path. But no, that started, you know, in 2013 in Nashville. I was, you know, Leo was brand new baby. And I was like, okay, I don't want to leave the house, let alone leave the city to go on tour for a month or more. And so I was looking for other things to do for the first time in my life. I might need to pursue a different career path. And then one day I was at the prosthetic clinic getting my leg, something tweaked on my prosthetic leg, and my prosthetist, my leg guy.
I don't mean to interrupt, but how long after the amputation did you get the prosthesis, your first one?
I lost my leg August 2005, and then the very first one that I started to learn to walk with was like the end of October of 2005.
Okay. All right.
So, you know, I was healed and all
I got you.
And learned all to right. walk from there. But I was asked to talk to a guy that was being fitted for a prosthetic leg, a new amputee that was healed up and had lost his leg to cancer. And my prosthetist, my leg doctor, had said, hey, will you talk to this guy that I'm fitting right after you, just on your way out, just 5 minutes? I said, I would love to do that. I feel like that's part of why this happened to me. I never get to have conversations like that with other amputees. Let's do it. I went in, talked to him, 5 minutes. He's seeing me, you know, healthy, walking around. Mm-hmm. And I could just see the hope in his eyes. And I left that day thanking God that I was able to have that conversation and speak that language, so to speak, to him. There's a difference in saying, I can only imagine what you're going through, and then saying, I know exactly what you're going through, you know, especially when it's something so, you know, traumatic and specific. Yeah. And so I went home and I told my wife, I said, I wish that could be my job. And so, very long story short, it became my job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you know, you've always talked about, and I've heard a lot of the sayings, of course, life isn't over.
Yeah.
Okay. It's okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
And I think those things are important to hear from someone like you who has experienced it. You
know? Yeah. Well, yeah. And I remember being in the cancer center and with people that are in various states of living, not dying, but living, but various states of it. You know, a lot of those people didn't make it out of there, right? All ages. And I just remember, you know, what the saying that came to me is like, okay, I'm alive with a disease that's trying to kill me. You know, you're also getting these drugs where it's this balancing act of trying to kill the cancer and not kill you. Right. And so I was just like, as long as you're alive, you got to live, you know? And I just was doing my best just to stay alive, you know, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, sure. And I think the other thing too is the fact that this costs a lot of money. I mean, it's not always covered by insurance. I know insurance companies aren't your favorite people, okay, which is fine.
Yes.
And I think that's great, okay, because there's a lot of people out there going, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the idea that you had to do your own fundraising or whatever to make sure that you got the prosthesis, and I think it cost about $35,000
well,
right
we,
in there
we
somewhere?
Raised $35,000. Okay. It cost $60,000.
Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly.
Because at that time in 2006, my insurance was only covering half of what I needed because they felt that the technology was experimental and new, and, which is hogwash. You know, it's all garbage. So no, I stand by the fact that no one is in the business of making money. Everyone is in the business of providing a service. You know, you're telling the news. Right. You're entertaining people by playing drums. You're a garbage man. You're a lawyer. You know, you're a teacher. Oh, dear Lord, teachers, thank God.
God bless
them. But insurance companies behave like they are in the business of making money. They do not behave. Actions speak louder than words.
Right.
And this is not my opinion. This is the truth. I know it. I'm saying it like my opinion, but it's the truth. They behave like they're in the business of just trying to make money, spend as little money as possible. And I mean, even doctors are victim to, you know, yes, we'll cover this. And then going, you need to submit that claim one more time.
Yeah.
And then we're covered. And then the doctors get screwed. Yeah. So yeah, bad news.
Yeah. So you have to go through all that. And every time, how many times have you upgraded?
Many.
Now, what I'm talking about is the technology is getting better and better.
The technology is getting better. I have more or less since 06, since when we needed to raise money for that leg. So that was the second leg. You know, there's a computer in it. Let me say this. It's not that I can drive a Honda but choose a Ferrari. We were talking about cars earlier. And our friend. It is not that. There's a lots of different kinds of prosthetic legs because there's lots of different kinds of human bodies. This is the thing that is appropriate for my body that functions most like a quote unquote real leg. So I have the first one we got in 06 and we had to raise all that money. And then I think I've had 1, 2, 3, or 4 since then. I just got a new one last year. You know, insurance is paying for them these days. Thank God.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah. Because now they're FDA approved probably or something.
Yeah,
you need that.
It's a whole, there's a lot of that stuff.
We'll go way down a
rabbit
hole.
There's a lot of that stuff, but yes.
Yeah. And this is what you're doing at Steps of Faith. You're trying to help people fall through the cracks.
Absolutely.
That these prosthetics are extremely expensive.
Yes.
Insurance companies aren't covering a lot of it because they don't think it's essential, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever to live a normal life. So that's what you're doing at Steps of Faith. So
yeah,
that's an incredible thing. And I know you and Jason Sudeikis, good friends. You met him. You were a senior in high school. He was a freshman at KU.
Yeah.
And you've carried on a lifelong friendship. He helps you with Thunder Gong, which is just one of many, I think, revenue streams that you're trying to develop. I think you've raised almost $4 million or over
$4
million.
Something like that.
Right in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's the biggest fundraiser for Steps of Faith.
Yeah.
And it's just a rock and roll variety show.
Yeah.
We're just making music together, and it's funny because Jason's funny, and we bring together, you know, other friends of his and now mine, like Will Forte and you know, Brendan Hunt, also from Ted Lasso, or Fred Armisen from SNL. Sam Richardson, all of these guys, but then also musicians. And everybody's playing music, but then we also bring musicians together. Like we've had, you know, Wynonna Judd and Chance
Tech
the
Nine.
Rapper. We've had
on
the very first year.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the very first year we had Tech Nine as a surprise, and shout out to Tech Nine and Travis and Chris Calico. I mean, people still talk about that as of all of the, you know, we've done 7 of these things now. 2 of them were online.
It's every year in November.
Every year. It's always the second weekend in November
at the
Theater. And, yeah, it's like, you know, it's kind of like a dream come true just to, you know, Summer Breeze is my band with my wife and my friends is the house band and we play with all these people.
Yacht Rock.
Yacht Rock, man. Come
really?
On.
God.
Everybody loves Yacht Rock.
I know
right?
you do.
Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah. We went from hard rock to soft rock adult contemporary music, but we'll take it.
So you're carrying your message nationally, probably internationally. There's people everywhere that this happens to. And we'll get into some of the stats here in a second. But how did when they approach you to become the executive director of Steps of Faith?
Well, yeah, I mean that was out of the gate. So when
that was right out of the gate.
When I talked to that guy, I said I saw the hope in his eyes, I said wish that could be my job. I went back the next day because I had another appointment with my prosthetist. I told him the same thing, and he said, well, maybe it could be. And I just kind of laughed it off. And so then right after that, he introduced me to the guy that owned the clinic. the prosthetic clinic, Rob Pittman in Nashville. Rob and I talked. He was like, man, well, you know, I'd love to talk about working together. And I was like, well, I don't want to work here. I'm not qualified to work at a prosthetic clinic.
I'm a drummer.
So, yeah, exactly. You know, I was like, I don't understand. But then we had a conversation. And I said, yeah, I don't really know what I can help you with or how you can help me. But I said, I've realized that sometimes not answering a question directly, but like, I don't know how to answer that, but let me tell you a story that comes to mind. Then someone goes, I got it. And so I do that whenever I can't always go, I want this or yes or no, but I was like, this makes me think of this. And hopefully somebody pulls something out of that and goes, okay. And that's my intention. So what I said to him is, that day I talked to that guy, I can't think of anything more than how I made that guy feel. So I don't know what that looks like. And he said, well, I do. Mm-hmm. I've got this nonprofit that I've established the 501c3. So that's the tax exempt code for a business. That's a nonprofit, public charity. It's been sitting dormant for a couple years. No money in, no money out. We've not been able to do anything, but it's a really good idea to help these amputees that come into my clinic that have no health insurance or terrible health insurance, and they have no way to pay me. They just need to get back to work, but they don't have a leg, and they can't get a leg until they get back to work. They're in a catch-22.
Right.
What if you come on as the executive director and you do this? So I always joke that day he tossed me the keys to a car with no engine in it, said, see what you can do with that. And 11 years later and, you know, well over 1,500 amputees all around the country.
Have benefited.
We've already helped. I mean, this year, it's insane. It's already like over 140 people we've helped just this year, which is crazy. So yeah, so it was I was the only guy right out of the gate, and you know, wow. I have two employees now over the last several years, but still real small, but we make a big impact.
Yeah, give a little shout out Jim Suptic, who was a band member too.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. Right? We were good collaborators then, and we're good collaborators now.
And Marcy Thiel.
That's right.
You know, and also Tyler Burnt. So yeah.
Yeah.
Or Burnt. I'm sorry.
Tyson Burnt.
Tyson Burnt.
Tyson Burnt, who is our current board president, who's great. One of my best friends from high school. It's a good,
keep that in the family. Yeah.
Yeah. Man.
So give me the stats. I know it's like over 500 people lose a limb every day.
Just in America.
That is.
Yeah.
I can't even.
It seems crazy because you don't.
That's 185,000 a year.
Yeah.
Right in that area somewhere.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's wild. Fortunately, there's an organization called the Amputee Coalition. It used to be called the Amputee Coalition of America. They do all the things that you would think they would do. They're just a very large resource hub, Amputee Coalition. And so, you know, they collect these stats, you know, and it's very true. And I, you know, when I first heard it, I was like, that can't be true.
Yeah.
And then now years later, I'm like, oh no, that's very much true. I look at the requests we get for help just at my office every day. And so, and they actually just even updated it because it was 500. It's like just over 500 a day, just in America. Other countries are a whole different, like India, the stats in India are insane. They just updated it because it was like, oh, over 2 million Americans. Well, there's a new study that's still in the process of being released. And so it's 5 million plus, meaning we know there's at least 5 million, but we know there's more that we've not accounted for. Right. Like the people that we're helping, you know, a lot of these people fall through the cracks. They're not even part of those studies.
Yeah,
you know
what
I mean? So yeah, it's a lot of folks. It's a great need. And unfortunately, you know, insurance companies are, a lot of people can't afford health insurance or, you know, they're bad health insurance plans.
Yeah, right.
So that's where we come in.
I think a lot of people think, and I know you've expressed this and other things I've heard and read about you, is everybody thinks they see, oh, thank you for your service. They think you're a military person who lost a limb in a war.
Yeah.
But they are the least amount of people
100%
who are losing limbs compared to just everyday Americans who are losing it through other areas, trauma, vascular disease, all those.
Those are the two biggest.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Veterans, it's less than 1% of the amputee population in America. So because of, you know, because I don't, I mean, for a limited time only, don't look old. every day there's more gray.
Oh, but, you'll join me soon. Don't worry about it. Okay?
I'll look forward to
that. You got good hair though. You'll be all right.
Thank you. But no, it's people, you know, we shine a very, very, very bright light on the military in this country. And there's fortunately a lot of nonprofits that help veterans. What veterans don't need help with is if you are one of the only, the last stat I heard was 1,558 since 9/11.
Wow.
So that's not a Vietnam veteran that got diabetes and lost his leg to diabetes. Right. This is in modern warfare since 9/11, there's only 1,558 folks that have lost a limb because of the conflicts, yeah. because of the wars.
That's so 23 years.
Yeah, and but 500 every day.
Yes.
So it's literally less than 1%. So people always just, you know, they again, bright light shine on the military, so they just always kind of assume. But it's like, that's why it's kind of like, this is not a negative thing to say about the military. It's actually positive. You know, it's like, no, it's these other things right. that are way less, you know, it wasn't a heroic act. It was like, I got cancer, you know, or it's like someone had some insane, you know, series of infections. And in yes. order to save their life, hot topic, they got this drug and then, but they ended up losing all four of their extremities in the process. You know, it's like, I know several people where that very specific circumstances has happened.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, but no, on the pie chart of causes for amputation, like those are the two you mentioned are the biggest ones, vascular disease, diabetes, and trauma. You know, there's motorcycle accidents, auto accidents. Mm-hmm. I know three guys that were like behind their car and hit by another driver, and that's how they lost limbs. And a couple of them were assisting someone on the side of the road.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it's yeah. crazy.
Yeah, our family's been affected as well. I mean, not our family, but one of our great friends, the Morgan family with, I'm sure you've seen yeah. a lot of this on Instagram.
Yes.
Is Bo and Bree and Bree Morgan, and she ended up with strep A and infected her entire system and
yes.
all her blood rushed to away from her extremities. And
yes.
she has lost parts or whole parts of all four limbs.
Yeah.
And so she is, she's a miracle. It's a miracle that she's alive.
Absolutely.
But these are the people that, you know, you just don't, it's not covered. It's not.
Yeah.
You know, oh, that's an expert, whatever, you know, the insurance companies or whatever. So they are fighting for it. Talk to me about how you help people in those types of circumstances, how they get a hold of Steps of Faith.
Yeah.
And any other organization you'd like to talk about who helps people in this position.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, Steps of Faith, we're helping folks that have no health insurance at all or no prosthetic coverage or like terrible prosthetic coverage, right? One prosthesis a lifetime or a $10,000 lifetime maximum, something ridiculous like that. StepsOfFaithFoundation.org. It's all there, StepsOfFaithFoundation.org. We also are ourselves, like Amputee Coalition, a little bit of a resource hub. The family you've talked about. Right. Of course, anytime there is any news about an amputee that anybody finds out about at all, they tell me about it, which that makes me happy, you know? We don't like to think about these kinds of things because it's scary. It's, you know, unthinkable. I mean, the cliche term, you know, life or limb, you know, what are we saying?
Yeah, right. You only have one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really only have one decision.
These are the two scariest things, either dying or losing a limb. Right. You know what I mean? And so dying wasn't on my radar. Fortunately, it was on Dr. Rosenthal's radar, but losing a limb was, and it was a nightmare. And then I live to tell the tale. So we end up, like the family you're referring to, you know, I'm happy to kind of, be a resource,
right.
For folks, whether it's, you know, we know prosthetic clinics all over the country, you know, we know great prosthetists all over the country that we can get people to. I know the prosthetic manufacturers because we work with them every day to help the amputees that we serve. And a lot of those folks are incredibly generous and donate money to us being a nonprofit. So, yeah. I think that, you know, as we're wrapped up limb loss and limb difference awareness month, you know, it's just kind of, again, it's this thing that people don't like to think about, but it's like, I'm here, I'm fine. My life was saved. Fortunately, I have access these days because of my friends, quote unquote, at the insurance company, to the right tools to allow me to walk around like a quote unquote normal guy. It's the new normal. I mean, I'm almost 19 years into this at this point. Right. But yeah, I mean, we're around. The need for what we do is unfortunately not going away. People are still losing limbs. Health insurance is a mess. So here we are, you know?
Yeah, and in your organization, you know, you said, you know, limb or life, you know?
Yeah.
And I think some people sometimes are so adamant about they No, don't do anything. I'd rather die. Okay. You give them a hope. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. This does not mean the end. Life isn't over because you lose a limb, you know, where I'm sure you've met people who said, I'd rather die than lose.
Oh yeah. And there, I mean, I didn't have to do the surgery. You know what I mean? I could have said, no, thanks. I didn't have to go back to chemo, you know, but I feel that it's safe to say I would not be here talking to you because I know people where that's been the case. They're like, no way. Mm-hmm. What happened to me, I was always a purpose-driven guy, and I had a full life up to being 28. But the most beautiful things in my life, my wife, my children, this job, which allows me to help so many people, but also just like have fun with my friends, raising money.
Right.
All of the most beautiful things in my life have come on the other side of, you know, quote unquote, life or limb.
Sure.
So I wouldn't change it.
Yeah. That is just, that's really incredible. Before we get out of here.
Yeah.
Two last things.
Okay.
You're a sneakerhead, right? You love it. I saw the story with Jason Snake. It's about how you went out in New York or whatever, and you come back to the hotel and you got a brand new pair of sneakers from Jason. And he's that kind of guy.
But
You when did this start? And it's funny because you think,
story?
But he only has one leg. But what's he doing with the other sneaker? I said, it's on his prosthetic. What do you think it is?
It's on the robot leg. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just talk about it.
Oh,
just talk about that a little bit.
I just have always loved shoes, man. I've always loved sneakers. You know, I'm 47, so that when in third grade it wasn't called the Air Jordan 1, it was called the Air Jordan.
Right.
And
had one.
That was the hot shoe, and I had them.
You paid for them.
My parents paid for them. You know, the full $60 or whatever they were in 1985, but not quite that much now. But it's always a fun thing that. I've loved it. Really, it can seem frivolous, but it's one of those things where, I mean, Jason and I were friends before that, but it's like it's a touch point for he and I. I have real friends who have become my friends just through our love of sneakers. I'm not kidding. I was on, I have a text thread with two of my buddies. We text all the time, just about that. And so it's one of those things where, and it also is kind of a bit of a, for lack of a better way to put it, like a culture point for me. It's something that there's a whole culture around that is of interest to me. And I love it. There's a nostalgia to it. You know, I'm wearing Air Jordan 2s right now. What I mean?
Yeah.
So it kind of makes me feel, getting new sneakers makes me feel like a kid. And it is one of those things. It's like, you use shoes to walk. I think a lot about walking with my life and also what I do for a living. So it's just a whole thing that I care about.
If you still had those original Air Jordans, how much those things
would be worth. Oh, man, I wish I did. I know. I'd have them in a glass case. Yeah, yeah.
With a little perfume in there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Not so great. Talk about Allison, Leo, and Goldie. Goldie's your daughter.
Yeah.
Your life and beliefs about Kansas City, of course, call this, there's just something about Kansas City. And, here you are, you moved back from Nashville.
Yeah.
And you're back home.
I'm back home,
So what are your
man.
Thoughts about where we live?
Where we live. I wore people out in Nashville because they always talked about what an amazing city it is. And it is. But I'm always like, where did you come from? What cave in Kentucky did you emerge from to think that this crazy city. Now it is a wonderful city and I don't have a chip on my shoulder about it anymore because I don't have to live with the bad traffic and the things that bum me out about it, whatever. But we just always missed it here. This is a special place. The Midwest is different and Kansas City is a special place. Everybody that comes here says it. People that have been here before, it hadn't been here in a long time. Friends are like, I forgot how nice everyone is here, and it's real nice. It's not like that whole thing in the South where it's like, we should get together sometime.
Yeah,
like
right.
And if they don't mean it, that's a whole thing in the South.
Oh,
in Nashville, it's weird. Why would you say something you don't mean? right?
Because it's the South.
It's the South. Yeah. Apparently it will not rise again, folks. The Midwest is best, baby. I love KC so much. And my wife and I say all the time, after we had Goldie, second child, there was less and less music. Nashville felt like an oppressive place at the time for us to live. We were unhappy. It was hard just to go down the street to get a burger with two little babies. And then moving back here, we say this all the time. And we've been back here since August of 2016, so almost 8 years. To this day, it is still personally and professionally one of the best decisions we've ever made.
Yeah.
We just, I love this place. I love everything about it. It's nostalgia from growing up here, but also it's like, I mean, I live like right by where I grew up, even in the burbs, but my office is in Midtown. Mm-hmm. I love it, man. It's a beautiful place. I always say, you know, the song was written for a reason, going to Kansas City. I mean, it's like a cliche to us because we live here, right. But it's like, I didn't grow up a sports guy. But again, that's why when you reached out, I was like, but I know that dude. Of course I want to do this podcast with that legend. But music, you know, for me, my point is, of course the sports is a very rich sports town and always has been. You know, I'm going to Comets games when I was a kid. I remember when the Kings were a thing,
all
of that. But it to this day, the performing arts culture and just the art culture in this city is rich. It's beautiful. There's like cool lighting and just like pretty, you know, structures on 87th and I-35.
Right. On the buildings.
Yes.
The top of the buildings are all lit. And
exactly. Yeah. It's just, that's one thing that Allie, my wife, pointed out when we moved back here, is there is attention to detail and beauty in Kansas City everywhere you look. And I love that. It's very intentional that, you know, there is live music in the steakhouse and that there is, you know, art on the structures in the suburbs or in the middle of some park or field.
Right. Or at the airport.
It's beautiful. I was emotional when I walked in that airport last year for the first time. It was incredible. No, I love the city so much and it means so much to me. And it's like, I'm just so thankful to be back here. Even 8 years later, like every day I'm thankful to be back here.
Well, Billy Brimblecom, okay, we are glad you came back and all the wonderful work you're doing, and you are one of the reasons there's just something about Kansas City. Thanks so much for taking out time from your extremely busy schedule to sit down and do this. This was great.
Oh, man. I loved it. Dude, I could talk to you all day. This is such a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you.